Blogging the Boys presents Cowboys Radio with Rabs and McCool. Here are your hosts, Rabble Rouser and Landon McCool.
Hello, howdy, and welcome to another edition of Blogging the Boys Cowboys Radio. I'm Landon McCool, and with me, as always, is Rabble Rouser. Rabble, I wish I had some sort of pithy, hilarious intro that could make us all feel so much better about the deep sadness that we're all feeling right now. But honest to God, I'm completely at a loss of funny turns of phrase.
Yeah, you know, it's like at this point, we're in the same position that, you know, the Cowboys are in when people are saying, like, you know, why can't they throw the ball deep or whatever, you know, like, why can't they scheme more offense? You know, it's like right now, the only thing we can do is like line up and go for 14, but that's not possible.
No, it's not. Well, we're here. We're not going to quit on you guys. Just like, I'm sure the team won't quit on us, but obviously the results have not been, you know, what we've wanted at all, to say the least. But you know, again, we are resigned to where we are, but not defeated. So what do we have on the show today?
Oh, well, you know, it's funny that you say resigned but not defeated, because you know, the bald truth is that history is not on our side right now, Cowboys fans. As many of you know from, you know, all the numbers that are circulating around the interwebs these days, no 2-6 team has ever made the playoffs, at least not since they started going to 16 games. At the same time, however, 29% of 6-6 teams have. So I guess in some ways this brings me to a question I actually wanted to ask you before we get to our roundtable discussion, which is, the lesson here seems to be that no 2-6 team has ever had a playoff-making run, since 2-6 teams have, frankly, never been good enough to engineer such a reversal to make a run. You know, we keep saying, though, the Cowboys are like the league's best 2-6 team. They may be the best 2-6 team, you know, ever, et cetera. You know, if only they had Romo, they'd be better than 2-6. All this sort of stuff we've been telling ourselves. And I think as the losses have mounted, the thing that I've increasingly begin to wonder is, is this really, I mean, because, you know, like the narrative of like bad quarterback play, which we held on to for the first couple of games, no longer really applies. Castle's really good games. Two of his three starts have been quite productive, and certainly productive enough to win. And it seems like there's a different culprit every week. And so, you know, I think we can all acknowledge this has been a very unlucky team in terms of injuries and the lack of turnovers, which are to some degree luck. But at the same time, I think increasingly we have to look in the mirror and ask the question, is this also just not a very good team?
It's obviously the question we have to ask ourselves each week if we're, you know, if we're really taking a hard look at our teams, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and honestly, this is kind of funny that you bring this up, because it didn't end up making my cut, but we each, for this roundtable that we're doing, we each kind of came up with our own questions. And one of the questions that I was kicking around, but I ultimately decided not to include just because I kind of hate the phrasing of these kind of questions, but it is an answer that I would like to get at some point, or it is a topic of the conversation that kind of feeds into this. And that is, you know, between luck, preparation, and execution, what percentage of each is directly responsible for the results that we've had so far? Mm. Because the idea is, you know, ultimately, I mean, obviously injury, which is, you know, especially the injuries that we're talking about when you talk about bone breaks, like that's all luck, really. Mm-hmm. I saw Aaron Rodgers fall on his shoulder the exact same way that Tony Romo did, except maybe slightly different angle, and then not break his collarbone. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And you know, with Dez's foot thing, I mean, it's a foot bone, so I mean, God only knows how it happened, and like it's,
yeah, but 1 degree angle,
exactly,
both of those breaks are in a slightly different direction, and they just they tweak themselves. They're like, ah, that hurt a little bit, it's sore for a week, and they're playing.
And then I'll add in this too. I would say that this schedule is it. I mean, it's not luck, because it's generated by, you know, you earn a certain amount of the schedule based on your previous season, so it's not 100% a luck thing, but I would argue that luck is that schedule is part of that luck category, and if you combine those two things, you know, the injuries that we sustained over, you know, unluckily enough for the Cowboys, a stretch of games that even when we were at full strength, you know, we were discussing as extremely daunting, you know, I think those two things obviously played a, you know, major factor in the results that we're seeing now. And again, I think you can also add in luck to the fact that those particular injuries came to, you know, two of the most, if not two of the two most important players on our team. Now, what percentage does that, you know, make up? Is it more than half of the, you know, result? And of course, this is all arbitrary. None of this is real percentages, but, you know, it is a good question to ask. Like, you know, what have we, and frankly, it's difficult to even answer, because when you look at the situation, all the play, I mean, everything's intertwined. It's just like the turnover conversation. You know, it's like we talk about how we're not making a lot of turnovers. Well, you probably can get a lot more turnovers if your offense is putting more pressure on their offense to score points, and, you know, how that all kind of feeds this self-perpetuating thing. I think this is a similar thing. Is it's tough to judge the talent on this team when, you know, you're missing two major components, which completely change the strategy of how both sides of the ball, you know, act and how they perform and the strategy that's involved. So it's that's the thing about this, is that it's kind of almost a fruitless, you know, endeavor to try to nail down exactly what the, you know, boogeyman is in all this, because ultimately at the end of the day, it becomes a quagmire. You know, it's all the muddiness of the information that you're getting. It's tough to decipher. And then at the end of the day, when Tony gets back, and, you know, now that Dez has gotten back, we've seen it a little bit. Once Tony gets back, hopefully we're going to see a completely kind of different team, and maybe all that evaluation that we made was not worth a lot.
Right. But I guess one of the questions is, then, if we talk about this whole notion of luck versus the fact that they may not be good, is, and this is something that people have been bandying around, you know, when Tony comes back, does that change the outcome of the Eagles game? You know, I mean, does that change the outcome of the of a Giants game? That, I mean, obviously, you know, Castle threw three interceptions, but they also had a heck of a lot of offensive success, and they lost the game thanks to, you know, a couple of bad special teams plays. So it's not like it's only the offense that's been contributing. I think there's a, it's just, as you said, it's a quagmire, and the information is so hard to sort out, because it's a very complicated equation. I think one of the things I kept saying last year was, you know, the winning equation is very delicate, and one little thing, one little, you know, a variable shifts slightly. You know, Doug Free hurts his foot, and suddenly the defense is giving up more yardage. Mm-hmm. And so that's certainly true. You know, thinking about, I just want to backtrack for a second, thinking about what you were saying in terms of luck and the schedule. You're absolutely right. You know, you're given a schedule. You can't, you know, it's not like they just, you know, choose every week, you know, who you're going to play. But that, I've been thinking a lot how different this would be if those games against the Giants and Eagles had actually instead been the two Redskin games. And let's imagine that the games against the Redskins at the end of the season were actually the other Giants and Eagles games. That would make all the difference in the world.
Absolutely.
You know, to have those two key games against key opponents who we've already beaten once at the end of the season, it would make all the difference in the world. Not only because the Redskins are more beatable, but because if you lose twice to the Redskins, it doesn't hurt in the same way, because you don't assume they're going to be there at the end. So there are all kinds of interesting little variables. I think, you know, the bottom line is, this team was good last year, but I don't know that they were good enough. I mean, we talked about it. Like, the equation was very delicate, and it is for all teams. But I think in some ways they exceeded their margin of error, because they continue to stick to a very kind of sustainable formula, and they also got a ridiculous amount of turnovers in the last month of the season. And I think this year we're seeing just how delicate that all is. But I do want to continue to kind of investigate this idea of whether or not this team is truly as good as we might have imagined, or we're even imagining now. You know, everybody's saying, oh, if Romo was here, we'd be 6-2 or 7-1. And I believe that too, but part of me also thinks it's important just to ask, really, would we? Are you sure?
Well, yeah, no, I think it's fair. And I think that the thing that I would go on is the fact that, I mean, without Romo and without Dez, like, we should have been getting our butts kicked in a lot of these games, and we haven't been. So, so, you know, in my mind, with those guys, obviously, the outcome is different. Now, the Philadelphia game, that is a little bit more of a difficult thing to parse because the influence that Tony may have had on the game might be more subtle. You know, it might be doing more to kind of extend drives or take more time off the clock. I mean, you know, like it wouldn't be, I don't know that Tony would have thrown 5 touchdowns and no interceptions, you know what I'm saying, as opposed to 3 touchdowns and 1 interception. But I think it would have made a difference, but it's difficult to kind of, again, all of this is difficult to kind of parse and you know, substitute one person out for another, because that's just one of the things that makes difficult, that makes evaluating football difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's a team game and not every player is the same. And then, you know, one different piece can change your whole strategy on how you are operating. So it's difficult. And to answer the question, I mean, you know, ultimately, I mean, they kind of started out, is it possible for us, even though the, you know, 2-6, no team has ever made the playoffs at 2-6. Is it possible to make the playoffs? Of course it is. I mean, it's mathematically possible. Of course it is. But is it likely? Of course it's not. You know, I mean, we have a very, you know, 2 weeks ago we were discussing about, or 3 weeks ago probably, we were discussing about, you know, losing the opportunity to play, you know, for our own destiny. To be able to, you know, control the outcome of the season still. That's, you know, that's 2 losses ago. And, mm-hmm. and we need a lot of things to go our way on top of the fact that Tony needs to come back guns a-blazing in order for us to win these games and in order for East even sniff the playoffs. And is it possible? Am I going to keep watching? Yes to both of those things. Do I feel like this could also be a lost season that we're just dead man walking? It absolutely could be that too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's unfortunately where we are. So keeping that in mind and where we are in mind, what do we have for the halfway point in this season?
So we, as you just suggested, we have 8 games in the book. So it's time for our midseason Cowboys at the halfway poll episode. And we're going to do something a little bit different this time. We've joined forces with the gentleman over at Cowboys HQ for a roundtable discussion of the season thus far. And we're actually going to have an extended discussion, half of which we'll post here at Blogging the Boys, and the other half of which we'll post at Cowboys HQ. So you have to go to both sites and check out both podcasts to get the full discussion. After that, we're also going to have our typical preview segment. We're going to preview the upcoming opponent with a gentleman named JC De La Torre, who's over at Bucks Nation, which is SB Nation's Tampa Bay Buccaneers site.
So we need to make sure that we're plugging our SB Nation site as well, because that's going to be a good show, and we want to make sure you're checking them out on bloggingtheboys.com, which is obviously who puts on this fine podcast. So go to bloggingtheboys.com for all your updates, your information. There's lots of roster churning happening right now, so make sure you're checking all your updates up there, injury reports, you know, see what's going on with Lee and everyone who's had issues this week and previous weeks, see where Romo's developing, all this stuff at bloggingtheboys.com. Make sure you check out their Facebook page, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter, at Blogging the Boys.
When lights are round table, we dance where we're able. We do routines, we call a scene, to footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot, we eat ham and jam and spam a lot.
Well, welcome to part 2 of the roundtable between the Cowboys HQ and Blogging the Boys. If you haven't heard part 1, please jaunt over to Cowboys HQ and take a listen to their wonderful podcast and listen to part 1. And then pause the recording and come back and see us. But here we are at part 2. I'm going to go ahead and reintroduce everybody. Of course, I have my podcast partner, Rabble Rouser, at Rabble Rouser. Rabble, say hello again.
Hey, everybody.
You've heard his voice just moments ago. Of course, the great Keith Mullins, at Keith Deuces on Twitter. Keith, say hello.
Hello, gentlemen.
And with us, as always, our good friend, Joey Ikes, at Joey Ikes on Twitter. Joey, say hello.
Hey, everybody.
And the one, the only, the great host of the Cowboys HQ podcast, KD Drummond, at KD Drummond NFL. KD, what's going on?
Well, hello, everybody.
So we are all here at the halfway point discussing Cowboys football. We, if you haven't listened to the first part yet, we all came prepared with questions. So we're going to kind of just go in a row, and each person will act as their own questioner and moderator. So I think we'll start this out this round with Keith. Keith, what's your question? And go ahead and ask it to the appropriate person.
All right. I don't want anyone printing T-shirts. I've got the trademark pending on Romo's Run. You can go ahead and start using the hashtag now. Get in early. But we focused a lot in the first segment on position groups. But I'm going to ask each of you to choose one player that can help make Romo's Run a reality if they step up from what they had done in the first half of the season, whatever might have limited them through the first eight games, and which one guy can step up and help make this happen and see to it that the Cowboys have a chance in this postseason tournament. And we'll start with you, Rabble.
I think that the group that's going to have to lead this is going to be the same group that led some playoff runs for some mediocre or otherwise mediocre Giants teams, which is the defensive line. We saw this in both 2007 and 2011. They were pretty weak teams, but their defensive lines were absolutely dominant and controlled games. And this defensive line is going to have to live up to its billing. So I'm actually going to throw out a name. I think one of the guys who we crowed about all through training camp because he had remade his body, because he was embarrassing the offensive tackles on one-on-one drills, is DeMarcus Lawrence. He's looked like a decent edge setter, a fairly solid run defender, but he has not been explosive in the pass rush, and he's going to have to step up his game. He's going to have to show us a little bit of that magic around the corner that he exhibited at the very tail end last season, because Greg Hardy needs somebody to be on that other side. Charles Haley needs his Tony Tolbert, and without that, it's too easy to just shift coverage to whatever side Hardy's on and allow the other end to get single coverage and just shut down the pass rush. And I think if those guys are making hay and causing people to step up, suddenly we're going to see almost Tyrone begin to boost his stats a little bit in the interior. He's been close a lot, but I think a lot of those closes would be actual actual plays, sacks, etc. If we were able to force quarterbacks to step up in the pocket just a bit more. So for me, it's DeMarcus Lawrence.
Very good. And Mr. Joey Ikes, one guy that can step forward into the light and why you think he could do it.
I'm going to say a guy that might be somewhat of a surprise, but may not be. And that's Byron Jones. Mm. He's probably been your best defensive player for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. And when you go back and you watch him on tape, there are literally 1 to 2 plays a game where he is this close, and I'm going to be really bad on radio and put my fingers up really close together and look at it.
Hey, that's my pick.
I can see it.
No, KD does the air quotes, and I'm doing the 3 inches short of a first down measurement from the referee on him, and he's this close to making an absolutely monstrous play. There was the play in center field where he knocks the ball out of, I think it was Reuben Randall's hands. He was just a tick late, wasn't there to make the interception, but reaches back with his right hand, knocks the ball away. There's the play against Seattle where he comes out of the middle of the field as Jimmy Graham runs a deep crosser, jumps the route, runs into Barry Church and misses the interception because he runs into Barry Church. There's the play at the goal line against the Eagles where he jumps the out route and deflects the pass. And if he's a step quicker, maybe he's there to make the interception. And that's probably a pick six from that guy, a 99-yard interception for a touchdown. Think about how that changes a game. And then there's just play after play after play. And the thing that – the two plays where they hit big gains on him, the Eagles did, was him trying to jump a route. So he's there. He's playing. One of the typical routes that the Eagles run is a big over route with Jordan Matthews across the field off play action. And they ran a couple of times that play action in the backfield, and Jordan Matthews would start across the field, stop in the middle field, reverse field back to the opposite side. And what they were doing is they had caught Byron Jones trying to jump that route. And so he's playing with confidence now at his seventh or eighth game of his rookie season, to where he knows what he's seeing and he's ready to jump it. And with a guy with that athletic ability, who's that intelligent, is playing with the confidence that he's playing with as a rookie, he's going to get real dangerous real fast in the back half of this defense. And if they can just put – if he can just stay – and he's always around the ball just like you want a guy to be, he's going to wind up making some really, really big plays in the second half of this season.
And Mr. KD, you have a guy that has an extra gear?
Well – I'm not sure if he has an extra gear, and that's the reason why I'm going to double up and bring up the name DeMarcus Lawrence again. Yeah, I'm well. Basically, it's because Keith didn't ask me first.
Oh,
and you know, I slipped him a 20, and I was supposed to get the first question. That's okay. We
talked about that.
Time.
It looks like exactly. I jumped the route.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. But. For me, I have, and I haven't voiced this very often, but I have a serious problem with the production that we've been getting from DeMarcus Lawrence. He has a boatload of pressures. I think he has one sack, but his boatload of pressures have come in a boatload of pass rushing situations. He's near the bottom of the league in pass rush productivity. And for my money, he's been a disappointment of a draft pick, even knowing that rookie and second-year pass rushers really don't get a lot of sacks on average. The Cowboys paid a premium price to get DeMarcus Lawrence in the draft, a second and a third-round pick. And for that price that they paid, he really does need to be the exception to the rule when it comes to creating this kind of pressure and getting game-changing plays. He's not making them. Whether you want to call him, you know, almost Anthony part two, or however way you want to frame it, they aren't getting the bang for the buck that they need to get from DeMarcus Lawrence. And just a little cheap shot, he went a couple picks before Derek Carr. And I think Derek Carr in this offense would have won more than zero games over the last six contests. So when I analyze everything about the situation with the Cowboys, I'm looking at DeMarcus Lawrence and saying, you have to do more for this team. And if he does, as Rabble pointed out, the trickle-down effect is so obvious. Greg Hardy is then now has somebody on the opposite side wreaking as much havoc and requiring double teams, which loosens things up for Tyrone Crawford, who is another disappointing player in my estimation so far this year, and the newly found Will McClay special in David Irving. Jeremy Mincy is missing in action. But all of these things become less important to the Cowboys if they have a second premier edge rusher. And if Randy Gregory is dealing with whatever effects of this injury or the lack of playing time or whatever you want to call it, and they're still minimizing his snaps, it has to be DeMarcus Lawrence, because we've seen one pass rusher, as great as Greg Hardy is, can't transform this defense. They need another guy, especially with the fact that the linebacker core is so decimated right now. So that's my guy.
I'm going to need a moment to compose myself, because I didn't know that you were going to slip Derek Carr into that conversation. Oh,
I did that for you, buddy.
I wasn't prepared, and now I'm a little misty about it. So, but we'll move on. And so, Landon, who is the man kept down through eight games that you think is going to break free here?
Well, I think the guy I'm going to throw out here, it may not be obvious guy, but we've seen him do it before, and I feel like he's going to obviously play a bigger role in the second half just based on, you know, the latest developments, and I think it's Anthony Hitchens. I think all these other guys that have been on the field have, they may get better, but, that rarely happens. I mean, some of these young guys may develop and that, you know, may start playing better in the second half. But Anthony Hitchens is a guy who is probably going to start seeing the field a lot more because of whatever's going on with Sean Lee and, frankly, whatever's going on with McClain. And we've seen him be a playmaker before. We've seen him make plays in NFL games and actually show us quite a bit in his rookie year. you know, this last 2015 campaign has not been great for him necessarily. I mean, he didn't have some kind of stellar, you know, preseason really. It felt like he had kind of tailed off or maybe plateaued in his development, but this is going to be a real opportunity for him to get in there and make the most of an opportunity. You know, we don't really know what Sean Lee's future is. I mean, this is kind of scary to have concussions so close together, and we don't really know what, you know, McClain's future is going to be like here. So I think this is a good chance for Hitchens to kind of step up and grab one of those jobs and show us that he can do what he kind of did last year and make plays when they need it and really step up and kind of fill in for an ailing linebacker core. All right. So that is Keith, and that's a great round of questions. And we're going to move on to KD. KD, please present your questions. KD?
Yeah, it would help if I didn't have you guys muted. Sorry about that.
Well, you know, that happens.
Yeah, so I'm sitting here talking, and I'm like, why are they still saying my name? Okay, so we all know that when Tony Romo went down, Cowboys fans on Twitter, on social media, everywhere, blog, comment sections, whatever you want to call it, most fans were saying, we can easily get 3 wins over this 8-game stretch. We'll be okay. The amount of talent on this team is too great for this team to fall flat on its face. And although the team has stayed competitive over these 6 games, 2 overtime games, multiple losses within, you know, a score or less, they haven't been able to pull out a victory. So my question for you guys is, what's the one thing that hasn't happened that you'd point to where you could say, if only they had, and that thing would have changed how this season has unfolded? So what's that one thing? And I'll start with, let's go to Rabble first.
Well, I think that the main thing that characterizes this 6-game losing streak, and in some ways the season in general, from about the point where Orlando Scandrick went down with a knee injury, is a terrible, terrible run of luck. This has been probably the unluckiest Cowboys team since 1974, and maybe in the franchise's history. So there are many, many ways in which luck manifests itself in football, which is in probably the luckiest of the 4 major American sports. If not, it's pretty close. So I guess I'm going to say, in answering this question, I'm going to take everyone back to 2010. So 2010 is the first time that Romo went down for an extended period of time with a broken collarbone. And, you know, we had an extended conversation in the first half of the podcast about backup quarterbacks and the profiles. And of course, in that particular moment, they had John Kitna, the aged veteran who had seen everything, the savvy vet. And he acquitted himself just fine. But there were a couple games where he threw for fewer than 200 yards. But one of the things that the Cowboys did consistently was they played bad teams and they got a lot of turnovers and they got scores off of those turnovers. They got like in the 5 games they won, they got something like 4 or 5 touchdowns off of turnovers. They had 2 against the Colts. They had 2 against they had 1 against, 1 or 2 against the Lions and 1 against the Giants. In many respects, the thing that's kept them from winning is they haven't been lucky. They haven't gotten those bounces of the ball. Tyler Patman gets an interception right in his breadbasket. That's a clear pick 6 if he catches it and you know begins to run. I mean, there's nobody between him and the goal line, and that transforms the New Orleans game. You know, I think that there are so many of these instances where they just haven't got the bounce. And you know, when you're not good enough to extend leads, when you're only good enough to stay close in games, those kind of bad bounces get magnified. And you know, they overwhelmingly stacked up against the Cowboys. So I'm not sure this is about anything they could have done. I think it's really just about the injuries and maybe a couple front office decisions put them in a position where they are subject to the vagaries of the football gods, and the football gods are fickle and cruel, and that's what we're seeing.
All right, my man Keith Mullins, if the Cowboys had only done what over the offseason, during the season, at any time in the last year of developing this team, if they had only done what would things be different right now for the Cowboys?
Well, since you almost made me cry, then I will say, if only they had taken Derek Carr in the second round and used that third round pick on Louisville linebacker Preston Brown, and never done this dance with the devil with Rolando McClain, then and certainly they would have won one game out of the last six, and we'd feel a lot better about their playoff position. So I'll just take it back to the draft, since I'm so anxious to start talking about the 2016 draft. We'll take it back to there. But I do think, and obviously I say that half joking, but I do think that, you know, you talked about at least the indictment, and I mentioned self-scouting a little bit earlier, and I do certainly think, well, I think that all backup quarterbacks are bad. I think that it does say a lot about an organizational mistake when you change backup quarterbacks in the middle of dealing with an injury. So when you have a plan B and when you willingly admit that your plan B was so bad that on the fly you're going to change at the most critical position on the field, then I think clearly the choice to go with Brandon Whedon amongst a field of lousy choices was clearly the wrong one. And I think that at some point in a moment of honesty, they would tell you the same thing because they found that they simply couldn't, tase him. They couldn't go with the shock collar. He's much bigger than a lab, and they couldn't make him throw the football. And I'm certain that they wanted him to be careful, but I found myself begging for Cleveland Brandon Whedon. You know, an overthrow in the middle of the field would have been a refreshing change, and we just didn't see it. So I think that I will go with the choice of all of our favorite redheaded stepchild of Brandon Whedon as the one thing that if they changed it, we might see a little bit more favorable position than we find ourselves in now.
Oh my God! All right, I don't even know if anybody can follow up from that, but we're gonna try. My man Landon McCool.
Oh, thanks. I can follow that.
What's the one thing that if they had done differently would have positively impacted this season?
You guys got this all wrong. All right, here's how you fix this. Instead of drafting Chaz Green in the third round, and I know what you guys are going to say, and maybe you need to move up a little bit, and I know you think that I'm going to say running back.
Nope.
You draft Jordan Hicks. Am I wrong? Suddenly,
nice.
you've got a linebacker to play middle linebacker or Will. You still have your starting quarterback because he wasn't crushed by Jordan Hicks, and you didn't get a pick six in the game that they needed to win at this last weekend. So,
church.
You draft Jordan Hicks in the third round, guys. Spark.
History rewritten.
That's right. It's like the Hitler thing that's going around. Would you go back in time and kill baby Hitler, or would you go back in time and draft Jordan Hicks? I would draft Jordan Hicks. Cowboys fan.
Yeah, I'm gonna leave that one alone and just go ahead and
as he should. Don't worry, KD. This is gonna be on our podcast, so I'm gonna have to answer these terrible emails. So,
okay, that'll work. That'll work because you know the Hardy comparisons, I'm sure, are coming. But my man Joey Eichster, to close out this question, is there one thing that you can point to that said if they had just done differently, it's a brand new 2015?
I'm going to go with a similar point to Keith's, but I'm going to take it a little bit further. And that is the point that they went into training camp this season hoping to have a competition for the backup quarterback position. But they depended on Dustin Vaughn, a second-year player out of West Texas A&M University, to provide that competition for the backup quarterback position rather than going out and either drafting one or acquiring a veteran quarterback who was a free agent. Like, I don't know, maybe Matt Cassel, they could have traded for in January or February instead of waiting until August. Or, I mean, Tyrod Taylor starting games in Buffalo and was a backup quarterback up until the last game of the preseason, they had the opportunity to go add a guy to create competition. And instead, they depended on the development of an undrafted free agent from only a year ago who got almost no reps to create that competition. And when it didn't happen, they defaulted back to the overgrown lab, and it turned into what it has become. And so if they had added a legitimate veteran competition for Brandon Whedon, maybe it brings out better in Brandon Whedon. Maybe it allows them to end the Brandon Whedon redheaded stepchild experiment and allows them to put the shot collar back in the kennel and go forward.
Squirrel. All right. Well, we somehow managed to survive that line of questioning. And Joey, if you can compose yourself enough, it is your question next.
Okay. We all love Mike Fisher. And he wrote a column after the game against the Eagles this past week that detailed the mood in the locker room after the game. And the basically to paraphrase and probably not do justice to what he said and wrote and has said since, is that it's been a long time since he's seen a locker room that was as defeated as the one that he walked into after the Eagles game, where Greg Hardy and Dez Bryant's lockers were empty when by the time the press was allowed in, those guys had bailed. You had veteran guys who are supposed to be leaders not talking to the media, denying the opportunity to speak to the media, leaving guys like David Irving and Danny McRae and those types of guys to stand there. And one of the things that Fish was careful to say was that that it wasn't about the reporters being mad that their questions weren't being answered. It's about the team not being willing to stand up and communicate with their fans after that type of loss. So the question becomes: is this the one time where Jason Garrett's team is going to quit on him? And if it's not, what is it that's going to keep him from reaching that point? And we'll start with Mr. Drummond.
All right, yeah, and if you're Just a quick side note. Obviously, the article that Joey's referring to from Fish, it's a premium article over on Cowboys HQ. It's definitely worth the price of admission.
And I encourage you to read it.
Yeah, to hear the quote or to read the quotes that came from the players and to hear his summary of what that locker room was like after the loss of the Eagles. It was eye opening, and this is coming from me who, before the game, was talking about how dangerous things looked for the Cowboys players, because for the past week and a half, the Cowboys players have been on Twitter searching their own names, replying to fans that have said bad things about them. Nick Hayden went on Brian Broaddus for giving him a bad grade on Cowboys.com. And it was just kind of like, what the hell are you guys doing? And it seemed to be that they were close to unraveling. And the way that they lost the game against the Eagles was just so heartbreaking for them that they really just were dejected for the first time all season. It seemed like they had given up. Now, they don't give up in game. That's one of the staples of the Jason Garrett tenure, is that his teams fight and fight and fight, and they keep coming back and keep coming back. And they did it multiple times in the game against the Eagles. The Eagles after the half went up 14-7, tie the score. 21-14, tie the score. 24-21, tie the score. 27-24, tie the score. They kept coming back. That's what they do under Jason Garrett. But I think the disappointment in not being able to stop them in overtime really hung on this team. And honestly, I don't know if they can bounce back. I'm not going to use that as an indictment on Jason Garrett's coaching, because I believe that his errors are more in, they're not in motivation. the shortcomings of Jason Garrett's coaching skills is he's not lacking in motivational skills. So I don't think that's going to be the issue, but it just might be too late to recover from this. And I'm a little bit worried because it seems to be a multiple week thing that came to a head with a loss to Philadelphia on Sunday.
Okay, Rabble.
In answering this question, what I'd like to do is actually, if I can, take you again back to 2010, which was we talked about earlier. Obviously, that was the last time the Cowboys had an extended losing streak, and that losing streak resulted in Wade Phillips losing his job because, he by all accounts, lost the locker room. I don't think Jason Garrett is in any danger of losing the locker room. I think he's got a better locker room. I think a core group of really strong-minded, willful guys. At the same time, they're not really necessarily capable or built to deal with this kind of a losing streak. I think the one thing that does give them some sense of hope, and this probably should have given the 2010 team a sense of hope too, so take it for what it's worth, is that they're playing without their starting quarterback. I think if Romo was in there and they'd lost six straight, that would just be an entirely different animal. I think they'd look around and go, what can we do? Like, we're clearly there's no solution. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. The light at the end of the tunnel is the fact that Tony Romo is throwing in practice. However, to me, the key here is that, earlier KD was saying, what could they have done in the offseason? Like, what is the one thing? And I'll tell you what they could have done. I probably have a better answer now for that. And that is, they could have treated this as if they were not a Super Bowl contender. So one of the things that happened in 2010, you'll remember, is they had won the division the year before. And so when they got into training camp that year, that was they actually had a hellacious training camp like the first week. And then, if you remember, about a week in, Dez Bryant got hurt. And everybody was bemoaning the fact that this prize rookie who had been lights out in the first week or so was hurt, and they just dialed everything back. They protected everything, and it was very clear that from that point on, their entire modus operandi was to get everybody healthy to the first game of the season. But in the process, they ended up getting increasingly beat up by the teams they were playing as every preseason game went on. In that particular year, there were five preseason games because they played the Hall of Fame game. And they actually looked great in the Hall of Fame game against Cincinnati. And by the time their final preseason game, I think it was against the Texans, they lost something like 27-3 and just got their butts beat. And I think something similar happened this year. They looked at the roster and said, you know what, we're a Super Bowl contender. The main thing we have to do is stay healthy. And that's all well and good, and that's absolutely correct. But the thing that happens when you're sort of line item number one is to stay healthy is you stop competing. The things that the kind of things that you do when you have competition throughout the roster and you're letting guys really work it all out, we didn't see as much. They were more prone, as Landon said earlier, to rest the offensive linemen when they had dings. And I just don't think that they were ready for the season to start. I think that we're just now beginning to see, for example, the offensive line that many of us thought we'd see from game one. So I don't think that this team is, that Jason Garrett's going to lose this team. At the same time, I think that there are some really eerie and unfortunate similarities to 2010 in almost every other respect. And so if there's a lesson for them to learn, it's that they have to treat every offseason as if the entire, the sort of national and local press are all predicting them to be 6-10.
Okay, to the dog trainer, Mr. Mullins.
Well, Rabble mentioned that I think one of the reasons, and a player will never admit to quitting, right? But it certainly shows up in effort and those type of things, and maybe on that level, it's a subconscious thing. But I think that this team does have the carrot out there. Mm-hmm. That Romo is coming back. I think among the things that caused the disappointment to be so grave after the Philly game is that you certainly had a group and a group that still had veteran leaders, guys like Jason Witten, that you have to believe that they were preaching a mantra that said, look, we've lost 9, we lost 88. we have to, as a group, come together and win a couple so there's something to save. And so, you know, I'm sure that mentally they're fighting this internal struggle with their own failure in that they haven't collectively stepped up. They haven't put together an offensive and defensive game together, and certainly not all three phases, to be able to pull out even a single win. And so while I think that this game coming up certainly is a good litmus test in terms of their resiliency and, you know, in the way that they perform in Tampa on Sunday, I also think that if you really want to see, and nobody really wants to see this, if the biggest test that this team could face is if they came back and performed poorly early in that game with Tony Romo in Miami. So to me, there's a tremendous amount of pressure building around that game. And I mean, you could say that it'll extend throughout the season because of the sheer percentage they have to win to get where they want to go. But to me, there's a ton of pressure that creates quite a coaching challenge around Romo's return. While you would think that it would be this, you know, buoy to their spirits, there's a great deal of risk to me in terms of this frail emotional state if they come out and get smacked in the mouth early in that Miami game. So I think that there's a big challenge in terms of preparation. They have to believe they can win. And I think that, you know, as KD mentioned, it's been a hallmark of Garrett's teams that on the field that hasn't waned, right? They've given continuous effort. But we've seen their belief that they could win. Certainly, I think that's what drove the quarterback change. I think that, you know, and I mentioned on our podcast, while Garrett wasn't losing the locker room, Whedon lost the wide receiver room. And so there are groups on this team, you know, and Rabble mentioned earlier in the first segment talking about how guys like Terrence Williams had shrunk during this streak. And so I think we've seen some of the frailties of some of these personalities. So I think there's a huge coaching challenge ahead in terms of making certain that you've got to hit the ground running with a guy that's been away from game action. So I think that it'll be very interesting to see how they work their way around that. But you know, obviously, a win in Tampa goes a long ways toward approaching the Miami game the right way.
Landon, have a swing.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a lot more to say than what the three people previous to me said. I tend to agree that I think the thing that, you know, the carrot still is that Romo's coming back, and I think that is a pretty big carrot. I think that Garrett does a good job of keeping, you know, this and, you know, outrageous success are the, you know, the two things that are the two reasons why you manage your team this way, right? The reason you manage your team to be a day to day trying to get better situation, it's the hardest to do when you're having outrageous success and when you're having outrageous failure, because that's when the message is hardest to hear, right? But I think we've seen the team stay on course pretty well when they were winning and not buying too much into themselves and not getting overconfident. For the most part, I think. I mean, I don't think that was what got us beat in Green Bay in December. I think, you know, so keeping that in mind, I tend to think that, you know, that we can get through this stretch too. I think that with Romo coming back, you know, not this week but next week, you know, I think that will definitely keep spirits up. And again, he's practicing on the field too. And these guys that are the heart and soul, you know, Dez Bryant and Tony Romo, maybe more the brain or the you know, the face of the franchise. These are the guys who are just coming off too. So I think that, you know, these will be the guys who maybe will be, even though Bryant is fiery and emotional about everything, I think these are going to be the guys who aren't going to be as disheartened because they haven't been at the center of these losses as the way some of these other guys have. And so hopefully they, you know, Dez especially can help kind of, you know, continue the energy level on until the winning ways start coming back to Dallas. Okay, Joey, good stuff. And finally, we will finish this up with Rabble. Rabble, why don't you kind of explain again what your line of questioning is going to be about?
So what I thought I would do is offer some mid-season awards. So I've got one mid-season award for each of our correspondents here. A way of kind of assessing where we are halfway through here. So let me actually start by turning this right back to you, my good man, my co-host in podcast awesomeness, and tell me what you think is the most surprising or disappointing moment in 2015.
Well, I mean, disappointing seeing Romo on the turf and kind of hearing him, you know, that combined with, you know, the audio of him or the lip reading of him telling someone on the sideline that it's his collarbone or that it's his clavicle. That was pretty terrible. I mean, you described it as well as anybody when you were talking about how you turned to your wife and was like, yeah, that's it for 2015. I mean, it's, you know, we've all been holding on to a certain amount of small false hope ever since that moment happened. Mm-hmm. And I think as the weeks have gone on, in increasingly brutal fashion, that has been chipped away slowly and painfully, I have to say. But I have to think that it has basically been a straight drop since that moment in the Philadelphia Eagles game.
Excellent. KD, what game, what game, and I'm assuming this is one of the last six losses, which game do you think they'd most like to have back?
Oh boy. A game they would like to have back. Obviously it would have to be, it's a tough choice because the New Orleans game, well, let me run through it like this. When Romo went down and they raced out to the early lead against Atlanta, the entire group of Cowboys fans worldwide thought to themselves, we can survive. I mean, we had spent the entire week convincing ourselves that the Cowboys were going to be able to be 500 over the, you know, over the 8 weeks that Roman was out, the seven games, and that they were going to be able to do this. This team was way too talented to fail. Basically, too big to fail. And it all came crashing down in that second half. And I don't know if it was the coaches bringing the reins in on Brandon Whedon after that overthrow of Witten that resulted in the interception that kind of changed the tone of the game. And since that point on, Brandon Whedon was not just he was a bus driver with limited routes. You know, he wasn't really going to the high school. He was going down the street to the daycare.
He could only turn right.
Exactly. He could only turn right. And I think, I don't know if it was panic or just thinking that they had enough talent to win conservatively, but when they changed their mindset based on, to me, that play, I think they would like to have that back and they would have still liked to continue pressing, especially with the fact that Atlanta shifted their defense to say, we're not going to let you run on us anymore. You kind of had to still target downfield. The same mentality and game plan that they gave Matt Castle when he was throwing interception after interception in his first game. So I was originally going to say between the overtime losses to New Orleans and Philadelphia, but yeah, it's that Atlanta game. If they could have approached that second half differently, I think that would have had a great impact on the last six games that we've seen.
Interesting. Keith, who is our midseason MVP?
Well,
if you say Derek Carr, I swear to God.
can we get him in a third time? Please. Handsome guy too. And I'm so tempted to take the easy way out and declare the quarterback that's been absent the MVP. But I think that's been pretty clearly revealed to most of the league and the league's fans at this point, even if they want to admit it. So for me, I will actually say that my biggest surprise, I'll just give him just a little bit of love. As critical as I've been of the secondary, I had zero expectations, and I was awfully hard on the frail mind state, as I perceived it, of Morris Claiborne.
Mo!
And for Mo to come from doing nothing in his career, after, at great expense, the Cowboys acquired him, to maintain the level of play that he has over this extended sample size, at least, and not just, and even when challenged and beaten, to seem to come back and continue to play at that same level, I'm very impressed. And the only reason that I would call that an MVP-like performance, given the results, is because of Scandrick going down. And so if Orlando goes down and Mo is what he's been his entire career to date, which is a absolute non-factor, this team is in extraordinary straits in the secondary because you don't get to use Byron Jones as a chess piece at that point. He has to start at corner, and while I love him as a corner prospect, they don't get to do any of the other things that I think they're going to need Byron Jones to do if they have any hope of exploiting the slim chance they have left of getting a playoff berth. So in that way, Morris Claiborne allowed Byron Jones to get the experience he needed to play with the confidence that KD circled, to play the multiple roles that I talked about in terms of playing safety in the base defense and slot corner in terms of the nickel and dime packages. And I'd be willing to give it to Byron outright, except for the fact that it really was Mo's play that allowed the Cowboys to get Byron all of that experience. And to his credit, he took all of it in stride and performed in the ways they needed him to. But my biggest surprise of the season is the guy that I'll go ahead and give that to. And that's maybe the soon to be departed Morris Claiborne.
A nice surprising answer. That's always good when that happens. And last and certainly not least, Joey, the most surprising coaching performance in 2015, either good or bad.
I think it's a guy. I mean, play callers will constantly be criticized, especially whenever your team is in the course of a six-game losing streak and there's been games where the offense has failed to score touchdowns and the quarterbacks have failed to throw for 100 yards and things of that nature. But I think the job that Scott Linehan has done, primarily since the bye week, I mean, KD talked about what happened in the second half of the Atlanta game and through the course of the next couple of games there. But the job that this offensive staff, and I'm going to assume that Scott Linehan is the driver in that, has done in altering the play calling, altering the players that they're using within the play calling to the level that they have, to add things that haven't been a part of their system in this team for 7 years. We've never seen jet sweep action under center or in the shotgun in 7 years in this offensive system. And we've probably seen it 35 times in the last three games. We haven't seen wide receivers lining up in the backfield this often, the way that Lucky Whitehead has done four or five times in three games the entire time that this offensive system has been in place. They've completely shifted the way they run the football. They've done all of these things over the course of the last few games to deal with the fact that you lost Dez Bryant for four or five games. You lost Tony Romo for seven games. You lose Lance Dunbar for the season. Terrence Williams is being what Terrence Williams is. The fact that over the course of the last three games, they've been able to muster the offense that they've been able to muster in two out of the three. Scott Linehan really deserves a ton of credit for the way he's called these games, for the way he schemed these games, and for putting this offense. I mean, if you look around, if you take Dez Bryant off this field, which he was for a while, right now, there's really nobody with juice on the offense. I mean, you have Lucky Whitehead, who has some juice. He's shown us the last few weeks some of that juice. And they've decided to find ways to use that. And you have to commend them for the rational coaching that they've been able to do, which isn't as common in the NFL as you might hope it would be.
Wow, that's great. Landon, over to you, my friend. What, let's wrap this thing up.
Yes. So, guys, I mean, all of this has been fantastic. We, you know, this has been quite a monumental event trying to get everyone's schedules lined up, but we really appreciate everyone making it, us included, Rabble. It's been fantastic to have everybody. We have to make sure we do this again because it's been too much fun. But I do want to make sure that we take this opportunity to thank you guys for making time for this, because this was great, and we definitely have to do this again. So thank you. And with that, we will end this, our first of hopefully many Cowboys Knights of the Round Table gatherings. Wow, that was really fun. I love talking to those guys. It's kind of crazy trying to talk to all of them at once, but we definitely have to do that again, because those guys are all fantastic football minds, and it's great to get them all in one spot.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, who some of our great guests over the last couple of years we've been doing this are, they're all those guys from Cowboys HQ, so it was really great to have them all together and in one round table.
Yeah, absolutely. What's next?
So I actually had a chance to have a one-on-one conversation with one of the guys over at Bucks Nation about the state of the Bucks. So I'll tell you what, why don't we give everyone a listen to that? All right, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together and welcome JC De La Torre from Bucks Nation. JC, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this one.
So JC has a very interesting history that I feel like I really have to share with you. He's a comic book and novel writer
Yep.
who specializes in what he calls speculative fiction.
Yes.
I have to say that, like, what is football prognostication if not speculative fiction?
Exactly.
And
you can definitely say that about my fantasy football team. I can tell you that much.
And so he co-hosts a sci-fi fantasy horror podcast, which is called Transmissions from Atlantis.
Yep.
But he's also a columnist and blogger for SB Nation's Tampa Bay Buccaneers site, Bucks Nation. And previously has done a lot of other work in this realm as well. He served as a featured columnist for Bleacher Report, in which he was covering all Tampa Bay sports.
Yep.
He was an editor and featured columnist for SB Nation's Tampa Bay site, where he covered the Buccaneers and Lightning, as well as the Florida Gators. But no Devil Rays coverage, JC?
I'm not the biggest baseball fan in the world, so I left that to more learned people on that.
More enthusiastic
yes.
reporters. And he's also in the past written for the NFL.com's Blog Blitz and contributed to Pewter Report, which is one of the top magazines on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So with all of this under his belt, we thought that JC would not only be cool to talk to, because, you know, he's a comic book writer, but also really well positioned to give us a clear eyed view of the Cowboys' upcoming opponent. So I'm looking forward to this one. Should be a fun conversation.
Yeah.
I'd like to begin by talking about the new-ish administration here in Tampa Bay.
Yep.
So general manager Jason Light and head coach Levy Smith both came to Tampa Bay in 2014 and have worked since then to overhaul the roster. So the Light-Smith administration has two drafts, 24 games, and I don't even know how many transactions, probably in the 50s now, I don't know, under its belt.
At least, yeah.
So give us a sense of the early returns. How does Bucks Nation feel about their progress thus far?
Well, honestly, not too good. And it's really their own fault, because when they came in, they told the Tampa Bay fan base that you guys don't have to wait anymore, because we're going to turn this thing around really quick and we're going to have a meteoric rise to the top of the standings and be a contender. Lovey's first season, that didn't happen. In fact, it was the exact opposite of a rise. It was a complete collapse. Every single free agent move that the Buccaneers made was completely wrong. Michael Johnson was a complete ghost at defensive end. He never really put any pressure on the quarterback. He was just there to collect a paycheck. Same thing with Anthony Collins, who was supposed to take over the left tackle position for Donald Penn. Josh McCown. There's too many McCowns in this league. I'm sorry. Right. Josh McCown was supposed to be the temporary solution at quarterback, but he was absolutely not a solution. And so things just fell apart for the Buccaneers in 2014. The one thing the Bucs could look back on was their draft. Mike Evans obviously came right out of the box and was one of the top receivers in the league. Charles Sims, it took a little while for him to get going, but now he's a key contributor. And this year, obviously, they brought in Jameis and Quan Alexander and the two offensive linemen who have done very well for the Bucs. So draft-wise, we're all pretty happy about the way that things have been going with the administration in that aspect. But free agency has been terrible. And the truth is, Lovey is 5-19 as a coach. So and he's only won one home game in his year and a half here in Tampa. So it's it hasn't been good. It hasn't been good.
Wow. One home game. So that actually gives me a little bit of hope for next weekend, because, of course, we're playing in Tampa.
Exactly.
So you were just talking about Mike Evans. Light and Smith have had two top 10 picks thus far, and they spent, as you were just saying, last year's, I think it was number 7 pick, is that right, on Mike Evans in 2014? Yep. And then last year, of course, they had the top pick in the draft, and they spent on Jameis Winston. So as you were just suggesting, Evans had a really strong rookie campaign. He got over 1,000 yards, had 12 touchdowns. I think he had almost 70 catches. So how is Winston faring in this, his rookie year? And, you know, in your estimation, what are his chances of developing into the proverbial, and I'm using air quotes here, franchise quarterback?
Actually, I think they're pretty good, because what we've seen from Jameis has just been an amazing transformation from a guy that couldn't hit the broadside of a barn in preseason to being the team leader. He's making all the different checks at the line of scrimmage. He's doing everything you would expect a 4- and 5-year veteran in the league to do, but he's doing it as a rookie quarterback that's only played 8 games in this league. And the most important thing is that he's finally figured out that he can't keep throwing the football to the other team. And that's probably been the biggest improvement in his game. He doesn't turn the ball over anymore. And that has enabled the football team to stay competitive in every single one of their games. And he's now to try to win these games. He was fantastic in Atlanta. He was tremendous against the Redskins. The Bucs did not lose against the Redskins because of Jameis Winston. Right. And against the Giants, he played very well as well. The big knock that I have on Jameis right now is his red zone capabilities. He still hasn't mastered the ability to be able to gauge the speed in the red zone, and I think it's hurt the Bucs. They've settled for a lot of field goals instead of getting touchdowns. They're still averaging about 23 points a game, which is pretty good, but and it's a 6-point improvement over last season. But at the same time, They left a lot of opportunities against the Giants. They really should have had a much bigger lead on the Giants, or at least been ahead against the Giants. They should have beaten Washington. There's no reason they blow a 24-point lead. And there was a sequence in the Washington game where they could have put the game away. They had 1st and goal at the 5-yard line. They could have put the football game away. Washington would have had no chance to come back, but they had to settle for a field goal. Washington takes the ball, goes down the field, scores the game-winning touchdown. So it's been kind of like that for the Bucs this season. They've found ways to lose games, and but with Jameis, there's hope for the franchise. There's hope for us finally turning the corner and becoming a respectable franchise. A lot of Buc fans nowadays have not seen a winning team. They don't remember the 2002 team that you know won the Super Bowl, and the 90s and early 2000 Bucks that had Warren Sapp and Derek Brooks, Hall of Famers. They only remember the losing of the last few years, and it's really a shame.
Well, you know, honestly, there's some young Cowboy fans who have had a pretty similar experience. You know, you're talking about the fact that Jameis is looking, you know, the early returns are that he's going to be one of those franchise guys. And I tell you what, you don't appreciate that more than when you lose your franchise guy.
Absolutely.
How rare it is to find a competent quarterback who can be a leader, who can be one of those rare, let's say there's 15 to 18 guys in the league who are actually mm-hmm. capable of being a quarterback who, you know, is of that level and distinction. So the fact that you yeah. found one, I mean, you may be saying that, you know, Lovie Smith is only, 5-19, I think that is what you said yep. in his first yeah. 24.
Yep.
But damn it, he found his franchise quarterback, and that's a huge, huge plus. It really yep. is.
It certainly is.
So let's talk a little bit more about the offense. So this offseason, Tampa Bay hired a new offensive coordinator. How do you pronounce his last name? Is it Cotter?
It's Dirk Cutter, yeah.
Dirk Cutter. Yep. So, and he'd been with the Falcons for the previous three seasons. And, you know, so here he is. He comes to Tampa, and he's tasked with a sort of monumental, Herculean endeavor in a way. He's got to assemble a lot of new guys, many of whom are in their first or second season, into a sure. cohesive unit. And, you know, I don't envy him that at all. So how has he and his offensive staff managed that? Let's start with that question, and then we'll move on to questions about, like, you know, what his philosophy is and how he wants to attack
yep.
Opposing defenses.
Well, Cutter's an interesting character. He kind of adapts his game plan and his basically playbook to his talent. So in Atlanta, the way that he called games is completely different than the way that he calls games in Tampa. In Tampa, he knows that the offensive line may not be the best pass-blocking offensive line in the league, but they are pretty strong at the point of attack. So he focused his entire offense basically around the running game. And he also wanted to take a little bit of pressure off of Jameis, which goes without saying. You don't want your rookie quarterback having to throw 40 times a game to try to have you win games. So that's basically how he's built this offense, is to accentuate Doug Martin and Charles Sims and the running attack. And it's worked very well. I mean, the offense has it's obviously not the Saints or anything, but it's been a very competitive offense. They've scored a lot of points. Again, they settle a little bit too much for field goals, but he's done an amazing job using the talent that he has, and he's had to deal with injuries. Austin Seferian Jenkins, the tight end for the Bucks, his first game under Dirk Cutter, he had 100 yards, a couple touchdowns. He was fantastic. Gets hurt the second game. He hasn't played a game since. Vincent Jackson, one of our top receivers, he also got injured a few weeks ago. We haven't seen him for 3 weeks. So he's playing basically with Mike Evans and a bunch of practice squad and rookie free agent guys. So that's basically what the Bucs have to work with right now. And so obviously the focus has been on the running game, and the running game is a top five running game in the league. So.
Well, that's definitely something to hang your hat on. So, you know, the Cowboys play a defensive scheme that's obviously very familiar to you, because it's, you know, Monty Kiffin's scheme, and it's now being run by his right-hand man, Rod Marinelli. So,
of course,
you know the scheme, you know its strengths, you know its weaknesses. How do you expect Cutter to attack the Cowboys on Sunday? What should we as Cowboy fans expect to see from him?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting. If Austin Seferian Jenkins returns to the lineup, I think you'll see a lot of him. If not, Cutter's offense and his core principles are basically the four vert offense, which is basically four wide receivers three wide receivers and a tight end, or three wide receivers and a back out of the backfield attacking a defense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so he'll and Jameis this season, he's not very accurate on the short to intermediate routes, but 20 to 25, he will kill you. And he's deadly accurate, and he has these moments where he can just pick apart a defense. Now, he's like any rookie, he's a bit inconsistent. There'll be times when he is nailing everything, and then there'll be times when he can't hit the broadside of a barn. But for the most part, he is an accurate quarterback, and he's also deceptively mobile. obviously, we all heard the stories from the combine about how slow he was, but he's already rushed for two touchdowns. He rushed for one against the Giants where he dove from the 5-yard line and flew like Superman into the end zone to get the Bucs within 2 points. He can move around the pocket kind of like Big Ben does for the Steelers. He can keep himself alive to where he can get to a point where he can deliver the football to Mike Evans or one of the other guys. Now, whether or not they catch it, that's a whole other question.
Right. Yeah, well, we know all about receivers who disappoint here in Dallas this year. You know, you're talking about Jameis and his mobility, and you know, I think mobility outside of the pocket has always been kind of overrated. I'm not sure how much that ultimately in the long run that helps quarterback play. You know, even Michael Vick.
I agree.
But those subtle little movements, I think, you know, citing Big Ben, it's a great example. You know, Brady is a master at that. You know, Brady is a heavy-legged guy. When he gets out of the pocket, he looks awkward, but boy, is he smooth with those simple little subtle moves in the pocket to buy an extra half second. And so, you know, if you got a guy who already has a sense of that, you know, this is like yet more evidence, which I'm sure you're already quite well aware of, but yet more evidence that this might be your guy. That's very promising news. And I'm just glad you're not in our division. let's switch to the other side of the ball. You know, obviously, we were just talking about the Tampa 2 scheme, since it's a system that, you know, we both run. We both know it very well. You know, we've been studying it ever since 2013 when the two aforementioned guys came to Dallas. So rather than talking about, you know, schematic nuances and stuff like that, I guess the thing I'd like to talk about is who in this year's iteration of the Bucs makes this defense go? Who are the key defensive guys? And are there any particular matchups that should make Dallas fans nervous come Sunday?
Well, I don't know about nervous, because I don't know if there's anything on the Buccaneer defense that's going to really make the Dallas fans nervous. The Bucs have had a despite what the statistics say, the Bucs have had a pretty rough go of it on defense this year. They're solid on first and second down. They struggle on third down. As for who makes the defense go, obviously in a Tampa 2 type defense, it's the three technique and the Will linebacker, and those two are Gerald McCoy and Lavonte David. Unfortunately for the Bucs, neither have had very good seasons. Lavonte David seems completely lost out there. He doesn't know when to drop. He bites on play action. He's really struggled in coverage. He's not the same player that was all pro just a couple years ago. And to be quite honest, we're mystified as to why that is, because he seemed like he'd be the perfect Derek Brooks style linebacker for the Bucs, but he just hasn't been able to either master the defense or understand the concepts of it to be able to be an effective linebacker in this defense. He's still going to make your 10 to 11 tackles, which is great, but the impact plays just have not been there. Same thing with Gerald McCoy. Gerald McCoy, obviously he's taken the double teams. The defensive ends aren't helping him very much. That's why the Bucs kind of pursued Greg Hardy. Kind of glad we don't have him now, but but then again, we could have definitely used his skill set, because the Bucs have struggled on getting pressure from the edge, and as you well know, if you don't get pressure from the edge in Tampa 2, you're gonna struggle, and the secondary has been just a complete mess. The Bucs, as I said, statistically look better than what they really are. They struggle mightily on third down. They're terrible, terrible in the red zone. So if you get it inside the 20, you're probably going to get a touchdown. At least that's been the case for the first 7 to 8 games. They did a little bit better against Atlanta, but Atlanta kind of killed themselves by fumbling the football away on their own without any Buccaneer interaction. They just pretty much dropped the football. The Giants, for some reason, couldn't get it in the end zone more than twice against the Bucs, but at least with Eli.
Right.
So the Bucs may be improving a little bit on the red zone, but they're still struggling mightily, and it's gonna be a long day, especially against the Cowboys' running game. Castle is a veteran quarterback, and the Bucs have always made backup quarterbacks look like Joe Montana. So, Buck fans are kind of expecting the same for Sunday, is where Castle's probably going to have one of his best games. Although I will say this defense does one thing and one thing well, and that's create turnovers. So, and I know the Cowboys have been having a bit of issues with turnovers this year. So that may be the one edge the Bucs defense has to be able to get off the field and maybe make a short field for Jameis Winston.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, in many ways, that and the Romo injury have been the story of our season in a nutshell. So you were just talking about Levante David and his sort of bizarre struggles, because it does seem like his skill set would match up perfectly with that kind of Derrick Brooks style weak side linebacker. And this is an interesting narrative, because, of course, when Monty Kiffin and Rod Marinelli came here, they installed Bruce Carter as that guy, because Bruce Carter is one of the most athletic linebackers in the league. He's, his skill set is, you know, stupendous and awe-inspiring. And similarly, he struggled to pick it up. So you, in many ways, you provided me with a lovely segue to my next question, which is, you know, this offseason, the Bucs signed several former Cowboys as free agents. So I'd just like to know, like, how are our guys doing? Tell me a little bit about Henry Melton, Bruce Carter, and Sterling Moore. And you know what? If you want to, you can even throw in Ori Lemon and our old cornerback Mike Jenkins if you want.
Do I have to talk about Mike Jenkins?
No, no, no. You don't have to.
Because Mike Jenkins should not be talked about, period.
Fair enough.
So the theory behind signing the Cowboy guys is obviously Rod and Lovey share the, a similar mindset. In fact, the Bucks tried to hire Rod, but Jerry was able to lock him back down. So the theory behind it was get guys that are familiar with Lovey's defense. And unfortunately, it hasn't worked out the way that the Bucs had hoped. Henry Melton started out the season. He's been playing nose tackle next to Gerald McCoy, and a little bit of three tech when McCoy needs to be spotted some reps. And he started out like a ball of fire. I mean, he had a couple sacks. He was very impactful. And then it seems over the last four or five games, he's just kind of disappeared on us. Hopefully he can rekindle some of that against the Cowboys, but he's really been invisible the last couple games. Bruce Carter came in. He was penciled in as the middle linebacker for this team, but he got beat out by rookie Quan Alexander. That's no slight to Bruce, because Quan's been fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been an amazing fourth-round find for the Bucks. And Bruce basically has been a reserve guy. He's filled in for Levante, for all three linebacker positions. So that's kind of been his lot in life. And then Sterling Moore, until last week, Sterling Moore was the forgotten guy. He was rarely getting on the field. Then the Bucks have been kind of rolling through their corners, trying to find some kind of combination that will be effective for their secondary. And so they started Sterling Moore last week against Odell Beckham Jr., and Moore actually held his own. He played a very good game, got an interception. Beckham only caught four balls on him when Moore was covering him. And so it looks like he may at least earn at least one more start thanks to that performance. Ori Lemon's a special teams guy and a backup linebacker. He's played pretty well in those particular roles, but that he's not much more than that. And Mike Jenkins has been terrible. Just every time he's on the field. And for some reason, Lovey has a complete love affair with Mike Jenkins. I don't know if Mike Jenkins has naked pictures of Lovey or what's going on with that, but he keeps throwing Mike Jenkins out there, and he's a complete liability in our secondary. Thankfully, he didn't play last week. He was kind of benched. So maybe the love affair is over, and we'll see more Sterling Moore and Alteron Verner, and hopefully Jonathan Banks will be back in the lineup as well. So and less Mike Jenkins is the better.
Yeah, these are all very, very familiar narratives. It's funny because Sterling Moore is like the good, tough little cornerback who everybody always wants to cut, but they just never can quite seem to be able to, because he plays really well. Yeah. So I'm glad to see him get an opportunity. I also would not mind seeing him try to cover Dez Bryant one-on-one sometimes on Sunday. You know, I mean, you know, we actually looked at a little bit of tape from last week's Giants Bucks game, and you know, he was installed last week as the left corner, and much like the Cowboys, usually do, so with some few exceptions, the Buccaneers seem to put their corners on one side or the other. They don't necessarily match them up with a receiver, regardless of where that guy lines up. And so, you know, last week Moore was lined up as the left corner, and as the X receiver, Dez Bryant would be, you know, facing him most often. So it could be, it certainly will be an interesting matchup. We've seen those guys go head to head in training camp, you know, last couple of years. So here's my final question for you.
Sure.
Put you on the spot. Who wins on Sunday and why?
You know, I've thought a lot about this game. It's really an interesting game because if you look at the two teams statistically, they are mirror images of each other.
They really are.
And the only real difference between these two teams, other than obviously the quarterbacks, you have a veteran in Castle and Jameis is a rookie. The only real big difference is in the turnover margin. The Bucs are plus one. They are a team that doesn't commit too many turnovers, at least not lately, and they do force their share of turnovers, while Dallas has been struggling a bit with turnovers, and that may be the difference in the ball game. And it's kind of why I'm going with the Bucs this week. I'm saying maybe something like a 23-20 type game. It's going to be a close game because these two teams are evenly matched, but I think there might be a turnover that kind of swings it the Bucs' way.
Oh boy, that would be the story of our season in a nutshell. Wow. Listen, everybody, make sure you're this week as we build up to Sunday's game, go over to Bucs Nation, check out JC's stuff, check out all the other stuff over there for your Cowboy preview pieces and your Bucs news. Follow JC on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at JC Delatore. That's spelled at JC Delatore. And I don't know when the Bucs are going to play the Cowboys next, but when they do, please come back and join us, will you?
I'd be happy to. Thanks.
Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Will Rabble, another one in the books. That's a great conversation you had with JC. What's going on next week?
Well, I'm glad you asked, my friend. Next week, we'll have Blogging the Boys front page writer Jim Scott, whom most of you might know as the real Dirk Gently, on with us to talk about the Tampa Bay game. And then we'll welcome somebody, as yet undisclosed, from the Finnsider, another great name, SB Nation's Miami Dolphins site, and we'll preview the Cowboys' upcoming opponent and the first game that Tony Romo is expected to be back under center. Should be good.
Thank the Lord. And before we go, we got to make sure and thank our Lord at bloggingtheboys.com. Make sure that you're checking out all the information on Tony's return, guys. That's enough just to hit bloggingtheboys.com over and over again all week. Make sure you check out their Facebook page, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter, at Blogging the Boys. And until next week, happy trails, everybody.
Happy trails, y'all.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?